Hello and welcome to Writing About Dragons and Shit, a podcast where two authors and writer get together and talk about the ways they tell stories. I'm one of your hosts, Trevor Bettis, writer of Idle Champions of the Forgotten Realms and host of Too Many Podcasts. And with me each week are two amazing people who are...
I'm Erin M. Evans. I write fantasy novels. I'm best known for the Brimstone Angels saga and the Books to the Usurper series.
It is I, B. Dave Walters, friend to all mankind, most all mankind.
Yeah. I like that. That's a good asterisk to have on the shirt. Yeah.
Friend of most mankind.
Yeah.
And occasionally I write some stuff too.
Well, hey, listeners, we're back with another listener question episode that you listened to just a little while ago that we recorded way long ago, and this one not that long ago.
Good intentions.
I reject linear time and all the other lies of the Jedi.
Yeah, no, it's fine. We're all set. But yeah, I went through the emails today. Well, like I don't mean I read every single one of them, but yeah, we have a lot of them. We're gonna be doing a few of these for a while. And also, thank you so much to everybody that wrote in.
Thank you.
And being patient. Thank you so much.
Keep doing it.
I remember a time on any of my podcasts where I was like, write in, and it was crickets forever. And so the fact that we're getting emails is just astounding to me. But yeah, so Erin is going to be doing the reading tonight. And so I guess we should just dive into it.
All right. So here's the first one. Three cheers for the Tangentier Triumvirate.
Love it.
Cheer number one. Trevor, I recently saw a t-shirt and thought of you. It read, I'm the ringmaster of the shit show.
I hope you feel very seen.
I do. I really do.
Yeah. Cheer number two, Erin, on Labor Day weekend at Portland's Powell's Books, I purchased Empire of Exiles.
Yay!
Thank you. I appreciate you.
You have excellent taste.
Cheer number three, B-Dave. Since January of 1993, I've finished reading every book that I've started except one. My bookmark has been marooned for several years on page 564 of book 5 of The Game of Thrones, A Dance of Dragons. The face speed I just made.
First of all, thank you. That's the first thing. So I can't even, here's the worst part. I promise I'm not going to soak all the oxygen up with this rant. That book is so fucking stupid, and literally none of it happened in the show. So I can't even say, like, hate read it. I'm like,
Stopping what's correct.
Consider the bullet dodge.
All right. It is clear that you enjoy each other's company. Thank you for sharing your friendship with the rest of us. Thanks also for sharing your hardened skills, knowledge, and wisdom. I'm about 50 episodes in and have committed to listen to every episode. You are special because I've made that commitment for only one other podcast, the Peter Attia Drive.
Oh. I don't know what that is, but now I got to check it out.
Well, yeah, I know. I'm like, all right, we got to help. That's
exactly high praise for this person who like the cut of their jib. Yeah.
Background. My day job is in sales. When not reading and running marathons, I've been slowly writing a fantasy story for the last several years as a hobby. Context for question number one. Recently, I was reading a fantasy bestseller, and 350 pages in, suddenly there was a remarkable scene. In an interview, the author said it was her most revised scene, and 30 versions of it existed. Mm. My question, on average, how many times will you rewrite a scene before concluding it's ready for publication?
I really like the cut of this person's jib, because they also work in sales. Mm. Let me tell you, because my answer is real short. I do so much planning by the time I get to the writing, I usually don't have to rewrite a lot besides just moving things just slightly.
Nice.
You know what I mean?
Nice.
Just like, yeah. I mean, hey man, Ball I ain't won no Pulitzers maybe, you know what I mean? Like maybe I should have been this entire time, but
I have a small tangent that I need to interject before I forget. We watched Hamilton, which I had not actually watched. I listened to the soundtrack, but I hadn't watched it. But for some reason, Idris was really interested in watching it. And we like warned him. We're like, the first half is fun. The second half is sad.
It's devastating.
He was like, okay, it's fine. So here's what I didn't realize. So I didn't realize that as much as listening to Philip die and then It's Quiet Uptown makes me cry, sitting on the couch with my tween son
Yep.
Cuddled up next to me makes me sob. And watching those people perform it, I was like clutching him and like racking sobs. And yes. I was just like holding his head. And I was like, don't ever get in a duel.
Yeah, no gunfights. No gunfights.
And at some point, he's like, I have to move.
Don't ever get into a duel.
That's just good life advice.
Right? We learned one thing from Hamilton. Don't get into a duel.
It really didn't work out for any of the people in the show. So
you know,
net loss for everybody. You know, the number one thing I took from watching Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda can neither sing nor dance.
Oh.
He has no solos. He only harmonizes, and he's never dancing. He's standing right in the middle while all this stuff is happening around him. And I actually respect the fact that the highest paid person in Broadway can neither sing nor dance.
Oh, geez.
Watch, you can't unsee it now.
Okay, back to the question.
Rewriting scenes. Yeah. Trevor, do you have an answer?
I mean, it depends on the scene. I wouldn't say that like every single scene is going through massive rewrites. I mean, I probably get a few in there that I'm like, hey, I gotta beat Dave. It's good as it is. but I mean, I don't know. I want to say like 5 at the most, as for where I've been so far with my writing. Like, again, I'm not published, so like, you know, who knows, there'd probably be more, but like, I would say at where I'm going right now, 5 at the most.
See, I would interject. Obviously, I don't know this person's process. I don't know what they went through with the 30 scenes. I don't know what 30 scenes entails. And hey, the book came out, and not only did it come out, the final product had an impact on you. So I'd say wins all across the board. I do think it's possible to over-sharpen a blade, though.
That's fair. But like, I mean, this very much could have been like they did a bunch of versions of it themselves. And then their agent came back and was like, OK, I think this needs a little something else. Oh, and then the editor came back and said that. So like, it may have been that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm lacking significant context.
So my answer is very much it depends. Sometimes it comes out and it's beautiful and I just have to make a couple little tweaks. Sometimes I write it and then I have to go back and go, no, you went too fast, fill it out, flesh it out. And sometimes you make a plan, you get there and you're like, wow, that plan was stupid. Yeah. I need to do something different here. And so that's, I think, where I hit the problem most.
Yeah.
Is honestly for me, when it comes to a scene I have to rewrite more than like once or twice, the problem is I thought when I started this, it was going to go this way. And when I get there, it no longer makes sense to go that way.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly frustrating. But I think it's a case of like, you write it and you know it's not good enough. You know, it's not doing the thing you want. I don't know the number, to be perfectly honest. It's as many times as it needs.
Yeah.
But I opened the first file I have for Relics of Ruin. And I thought I could just look and see like how many things are in the trash. It's so many files. And some of that is that once I got around the midpoint of the book, trying to make all the events that need to happen sync up properly turned out to be really difficult. And some of the things I thought should happen, I realized were wrong. That basically that they would end up spinning off a whole lot more issues that I wanted, you know. For example, one of the plot lines in Relics of Ruin is that Richa, the vigilant, the sort of cop character, is under investigation for possibly being the guy who did the murder.
Mm-hmm. Dun, dun, dun.
Right. And so at that point in the book, there's a theft. Something gets stolen. And originally I had it stolen from the Vigilant Kinship. So basically from the precinct, right? Mm-hmm. And so it looks like he did it. And then I realized, thinking about it, this is incredibly risky. And I don't know that it makes any sense for the person stealing things to do this. Yes, it does a really good job of pointing back at Richa and re-upping that tension. But I'm asking my villain to do something that where the risk is so much higher than the reward.
It's like the obligatory, I allowed myself to be caught.
Right.
Like, so I could be standing here at this exact second when the train comes.
And so that kind of thing, I think, makes you have to stop and go, wait, what am I doing and where am I doing it and where is this going? And for Relics, that was a lot because there were, you know, a couple points where I went, wow, this no longer makes sense. What does make sense? And sort of being willing to try stuff and throw it away. But I do that a lot more in my process, to sort of write it wrong and then chuck it and write it better and then chuck it and then write it best. I don't think I could say I've ever done it 30 times, but you know, there, and I think B-Day's right. You can totally over sharpen a blade. And I think learning when it's getting there is an important skill.
Yeah.
There's definitely, yeah. I can feel it. I can feel it in my brain where I'm like, you need to walk away from this now. And that is harder.
Because I would say, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't say here, even though obviously I'm the high priest of planning. just like what Aaron just said, though, the plan can absolutely change. You know, that you could be like, this is when they pull the trigger. And you get there and you're like, this person would not pull the trigger.
Yeah.
And that is okay. That is super valid. But Trevor, didn't you mention having like rewritten entire novels and stuff like that? Yeah, man. Zone of safety. I could never.
I don't count that specifically because those versions were so different.
Yeah.
Like one of them was just a first attempt and it was bad. Then I tried switching it to first person. Then I brought it back to more of how it was before, but you know, completely redid the plot and everything like that. So while they were the same characters and like, you know, aesthetic, it wasn't, they were very different stories.
Yeah, that's good. All right, that's valid. All
right. Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing's valid. It's creativity, but you know
what I mean. I know what you mean.
Okay. Please keep writing and podcasting. P.S. My oldest child just graduated from the University of Washington with a linguistics degree and a Turkish minor. They read and are proficient in English, first language, French, Japanese, and Turkish. They're working on a webcomic, and as per this podcast's direction, they've been reading Jim Zub's website.
Hey!
Thank you!
Hey.
All the best, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
Good on you, Jim. Good on you all across the board. I would say this one last thing. I think if you find yourself spinning the wheels, I think 5 was a good number with Trevor. I would say no matter what, if you just to give you something actionable, if you've done it more than 5 times, finish the story and then come back. And it may be clearer where that needs to hook in. And it may be clearer that, oh, I actually needed to zig when I zagged here. Or maybe it's perfect. When in doubt, finish.
Ready for another one?
Yeah.
Always.
Hello. All right. Enough small talk. First, telling me my favorite curmudgeon. First, telling me my favorite curmudgeonly Elogian will have a much bigger role in Relics of Ruin while we are still months from the release gives me ouchies on the inside, but I forgive you. Thank you. You are truly a saint. So here's my question. I know outlining and structure have been discussed ad nauseum, but I find myself in the position Trevor mentioned of wanting to find an actual descriptions of steps one could follow for making an outline. And given that I also have a fun ADHD brain and thought your outline process might be useful, I thought that I would ask you to do unto us what no one did for you and go through your outlining process step by step. Thank you so much in advance. P.S. I know you guys had a fun activity planned for episode 50. Any chance that might be something you do for the big 100, which we did one. There seems to be an attachment to this, Trevor, because it says I made a one-panel comic of you guys, but I'm not a comic artist at all. It's attached.
I didn't put it in the what I sent you, but this is from Zachary, who's written in before, and I think it is great art. And I approve of it. I'm putting it into the Zoom chat right now.
Okay.
I'm going to read for the listeners what this is. So I'm holding a sword and angrily pointing at B Dave, and I'm saying, you've called out me from 10 years ago for the last time. And then B Dave, with his arms up and muscles and six pack, these are all stick figures, by the way, which is the best part, says, Trevor, I love you unconditionally, but I will break you in half. There's an asterisk extra Arkansas on the word half. And then sitting in front is Aaron with a book that says Summoning Kaiju God Monsters 101 and a thought bubble that says, yes, once the blood of a titan has been shed, all will be ready.
I have never felt more seen.
It's fantastic.
You know, the best part about this is I legit just asked you about rewriting the novel.
I know! You literally did just call out 10 years ago, me!
It could not be more perfect. And I am wearing a muscle shirt. It could not be more... Yeah, it could not be...
I was thinking about Dark Rituals through that whole conversation.
There you go. And I'm sure Trevor's got a sword within arm's reach.
I've got a lightsaber, at least.
Mm-hmm. Completely counts.
Yeah, there's a sword by my front door, so
you've got to you got to put this on Twitter once this episode comes out.
Okay, I will do my best to remember. Listeners, if I forget, bug me.
You know, here's what's wild: the stick figures look like us.
I know. I wanted a hug from stick figure B Dave when he said he loved me unconditionally. Okay, so outlining process. I think I can't remember how detailed we got on this, but you know what, screw it. Well, if you didn't hear that one, you can hear it again. My outlining process as it is right now has some options. One of the things that I do now, because of B-Dave, is I do a beat sheet where I first go in with numbers on like a Google Doc and put in what I know I want to happen.
This, and then get another reason why I love you unconditionally.
And then I go in and put in the scenes that need to happen in order to make those beats happen. And once I've got that, I'm like, cool, that's my first draft of an outline. And what I will probably go do from there is make in Scrivener like a doc for each chapter. As I'm going, I will put in like, okay, here's what I originally wrote for this section, and then bullet point out a little more detailed thing of how I see that going through. And from there, then once I have that, like I have that off to the side and I'm writing and following along with the bullet points that I've done that expand out from that original beat. But that's mine right now.
Yeah, I will say, full disclosure, while I do not use it, I didn't hate the snowflake method.
That is true. Mm-hmm. The snowflake method was good too. Yeah.
Especially if you're just looking for a framework, again, to very quickly paraphrase like what Trevor was saying, my process is heavily inspired by Save the Cat, but over the years I've kind of developed my own thing I do. But with the beats, again, it's you write down the pivotal events of the book, you start the story, you start to fill in what must happen before and after that until you just sort of have a list of things, and the list of things is like, they rob the bank. They get away. You know, Romeo meets Juliet. Juliet's father doesn't approve. Romeo sneaks to see Juliet. They try to elope. It doesn't work. They accidentally get killed. The end. And continue to just sort of like, until you just sort of have a list of like a sentence. And then flesh that out as much as you want. Believe it or not, at this point, when I'm actually doing things, my whole process is slightly more involved than that, but at least in this stage in the outline, it doesn't say much more than Romeo professes his love to Juliet. Mm-hmm. Like I might go so far as to say professes his love to Juliet on her balcony. Like I don't actually do a ton more than that.
I definitely do.
Yeah.
I definitely get a little in the weeds. Heck, even if I'm picturing the scenes in my head as they're going through and I see and I hear a piece of dialogue that I like, I'll even just throw that in real quick. It's like, hey, if you want to use that later future Trevor, there you go.
Yeah. No wrong way to do it. But then I will literally take the beats and I will paste it into the document. And I will be like, number one, this happens. And I will write that. and then I will erase that beat. Like, I'll keep a separate list, so I always have the whole list and contiguous, but I'm like, once I've done the first thing, I erase the first thing, and then I'm like, okay, well, now's the next thing, and I do the next thing, and then I erase that and do the next thing. Do recall that because I mostly work in screenplays, I do novels and short stories as well, but I mean, my primary medium is screenplays. It's much more restrictive about page counts and what needs to be happening by where and stuff like that. So that kind of helps me handle things a little bit that at this point, I just kind of know, you know, by this page, I need to be here. Like I have roughly 2 pages to get X done. I have roughly 3 pages to get Y done. So. But that's not a thing in novels.
I was trying to find an example. But, oh my God, it's so hard to track stuff down. Okay, so generally what I do is nonsense, but it works for me. Which is that essentially what I do when I write an outline is I kind of do a stream of consciousness draft. I kind of just describe what I think should happen in each chapter. And I do it as I'm doing it. I might talk to myself. Maybe he goes here. Maybe he goes there. Oh, no, he goes to this third place. I don't worry about sounding proper. I fill it with slang. I fill it with curse words. When I used to write D&D novels, I had to send my outlines in for approval before I could start writing, and I'm really just trying to find an example of this because I want to be clear, it is something that I think fundamentally unless you are writing tie-in fiction, in which case you do have to have an outline approval, an outline is for you, so you should not fuss about it. You should do whatever you need to do. For me, you know, that does mean making a lot of words, but that is the thing that helps get me into the like flow of the story, which is how I'm gonna find what I should be doing, you know, narratively. And if you do have to send it in, I have been told they're very entertaining to read. It's the kind of thing where it definitely, you know, if I tell people, when I was doing it and I would tell people how long my outlines were, it was, man, I thought I found one. I was so excited for a second. Okay, never mind. I'm not going to worry about it. It is a big chunk of text, but it's the thing that helps me get the story down. It does sometimes still have the problem of you get to the middle and you go, oh, wait, this is wrong, because you weren't actually writing a fleshed out story. You weren't actually like finding the characters. You're kind of just going like, maybe it goes like this. So that might work for you. I cannot do bullet points. I can't do the really pared down kind of outline. I know a lot of people, that's what works best. That if they do more than that, they sort of lose the spark of the story. But I have also known people who had a hard time outlining, didn't think they could outline, and tried my silly method and went, oh, that's what works for me.
Okay.
So truly, 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 if you're like, I don't know if I know how to outline or if I'm an outlining person, but I am finding that, you know, discovery drafting is not getting me to a finished book. This is sort of like a half-assed discovery draft almost. If you're just kind of telling yourself a story in a very casual way and breaking it into chapters, that's the other thing I do. I always break it into chapters and mark like whose point of view do I think it's going to be. And then I'll take that and I'll break it on Scrivener and like kind of break each scene out and make all the files.
See, that's super valid though. And I think if you go the wordier outline route, that's just going to help you with the other words down the road. So, you know, still a W.
I also find like it keeps me like it's easier to catch like a flow state in that case. So I get more words down faster.
Do you have a ballpark of like how many words you end up with in that?
I was trying to find one. So that's a revision outline, that won't count. This one's not done. This one's like 4,000 words. My Watsy ones are a lot longer. The The RuneScape book, I had to do one. That one.
Because you can talk about that now.
I can talk about it. That one is a little, I didn't know my editor, so that one was a little more, I tried to sound more reasonable. I didn't have curse words. It is, that's
it's characters. A big Nobody flipping needs frog.
That's 5,300 words.
Okay.
And the, I'm pretty sure that my ones for Brimstone Angels books would routinely get up to like 10 or 12,000. Like okay. They're big. They're really big.
I remember.
But those are not small books.
I did one of those outlines for a book a few years ago, like after you had been talking to me about it. And I think I ended up with like 16,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think obsessively long outline for me would be 1,000.
Fair.
I love it.
This is gonna make me a little nuts.
It's okay. We can go to the next question.
It exists. Okay, fine.
I think we answered that one sufficiently. And again, okay. Zach, thank you so much for the art.
This one is has a lot of details about a book, which I am gonna attempt to summarize. So it says, literary lady and 10 gentlemen, thank you for your feedback on my last email about theme. I know I was extremely vague on what exactly I was trying to write, but my brain said they're recording. They don't need 10,000 years of history. But now I realize that maybe, just maybe, sometimes context is good and helpful even. So here's the gist. It is a fantasy story. It has a time travel premise. So you have a pair of siblings that sort of disappear. And the part one is current day characters just trying to find what happened to that pair of siblings. Part two is a sort of flashback. It shows you what happened to the siblings. And then part three is meant to jump back to the present day to show characters reacting to and processing what happened. And the concern here is this part. The thing is, I'm not sure it would be as interesting or have as much momentum as the other two acts. There are no more secrets to reveal, no other memories the audience needs to see. So in comparison, it feels like just a bunch of self-indulgent character bonding where they have honest conversations and heart-to-hearts. So they're trying to decide, should they put something else into part three? Because they feel like it's too late to introduce something new. It could have the player characters literally plan what happens next. It feels a little too on the nose, like one of those final episodes with the montage and a narrator or text explaining what each of the characters did after the events of the story and what they went on to become. So I think my question this time is this: how does one handle the falling action? On the one hand, I don't want to wrap up the story too quickly. On the other hand, I don't know if there's enough to carry a whole third act. I don't want to drag it out and make it longer than it needs to be. Maybe I need to let it go and just write a linear storyline. Maybe I'm making it too complicated and I don't need to do any of that. Either way, I hope this email finds you well. Thank you so much for your time, especially since I know this email is now so, so long. And even I'm not sure where the best places to cut it are. Sincerely, Susie. P.S. I felt a lot more confident about my abilities and ideas after a certain 14-day writing course. I found the instructor very encouraging, so please tell him thank you for me.
Hey, you got you, listener. You can't hear my groove, but it's
a good groove.
That is true. There was a groove there. Thank you. Appreciate that. Appreciate the good groove.
So I have two thoughts here. One is, I don't think you necessarily have to go for a linear structure. Yeah. But if there is nothing that happens after you show us what happened in the second part, then I don't know if this is the correct structure. If you have a scenario where we have to find these missing siblings because then we can do the thing, then this structure could be really cool.
Yeah.
I was telling Trevor, it reminds me of, and I forgot the name again, but someone said you should watch Star Wars movies.
The Machete Order.
Yes. So the idea is you watch episode 4, you watch episode 5, then you go back, you watch optional 1, then 2 and 3.
Yeah. You cut one out completely.
One if you're a child.
This is the way that I recommend. It's funny. I didn't know it had a name. I came upon this all on my own, but yes.
Right? And then you come back around and watch 6.
Yeah. It's it's a very hype way of watching those movies.
Well, it all hits very different when you don't necessarily know how this is all going to play out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 6 is the way.
But I do feel like the reason that works is because it puts a lot more sort of emotional emphasis on what is going to happen to Darth Vader, right? That's really satisfying. And so if it's just what happened to these siblings, and then we find them, and then we see what happened to them, and that's it, then I don't know that this is where you want to go. So that is one thing. You said, you know, you feel like you're going to add a third thing too late. I say, start adding it at the beginning and make it kind of the point of having both of these. The other thought I had is that it is common to have books where you have sort of alternating chapters of the present and the past.
Yeah.
And depending on what the story is with the siblings and how much has to sort of be revealed, if you're sort of slowly revealing what happened and slowly showing how they search for them, this might work really well. I'm listening to The Witch King by Martha Wells, which does this. You have past chapters, you have present chapters. Last year I listened to The Book Eaters, which does the same thing. The risk with this one is that if they don't have sort of equal balance, it can be kind of tricky to pull off. If it becomes extremely clear by telling me what's happening in the present, what happened in the past, those chapters kind of get a little sloggy.
Yeah.
But that is entirely dependent on your story. I think those could both work very well and still kind of keep that nonlinear structure that you're drawn to.
Yeah.
Yes to all of that, of course. I would say, you know, roughly the third act is 25% of the book. The first act is roughly 25%. The second act is roughly 50%. And the third act is roughly 25%. Roughly. I like 5-act structure myself. So I would say, pending what it is your big done moment is, I say move it later in the story. Move it to the third act.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking about a lot of crime dramas. And a lot of times you spend the whole time trying to figure out the mystery. The whole time trying to figure out what happened. And then usually you get the big reveal. This is what happened. And usually someone goes to jail or they don't, and then that's the end, you know. You're like, oh well, we're done here. Unless something else terrible is about to happen, you usually don't get a lot of that's what happened, done. And the next day we went back to school, you know, like that's it sort of saps the air out of your own thing.
Yeah.
So I would say my advice would be move, let the climax be the climax.
Yeah.
And if you've done that, then the falling action should come relatively organically. That, like, well, because that happened,
yeah,
this and this, the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. A denouement doesn't usually take, it definitely doesn't take 25% of the book.
Yeah.
It's like a chapter. Maybe two if you're wrapping up something really, really large. But yeah, it's sort of like, what other things need to be settled so that you have a satisfying landing to it? Which doesn't mean you have to tell me what everybody, like you're saying, like what everybody went on to do. That might not be the point. But yeah, you can't stretch that over that long.
I believe I mentioned this in a certain aforementioned writing course, but Google Blake Snyder's 5-point finale. It's the same guy that wrote Save the Cat. He's got a 5-point finale of a way to structure your denouement in a way that is satisfying, and it will probably help you put a little meat on the bones of what's going to happen and wrap it up in a fulfilling way.
I don't feel like my advice is helpful right now.
It's gonna help me, Trevor.
Because here's the thing: like, if this is like your debut novel that you're working on, everything like this, I would not send what I'm about to say to an agent ever. But like, if I was reading a book and they were like doing this mystery and they're trying to figure out this thing in the past and all that stuff, and then they get to a point, they're like, oh, this is it, this is the answer, and then it says end of part one, part two, the pass, I'd be like, let's freaking go. Because I'm like, I just spent this amount of the book wanting to know what's going on. I'm going to get a detailed account of what happened. Let's go. And then even to just have, like, you know, have the epilogue, like have the rest of the story be that past thing, have the epilogue be them back in the present being like, well, this is what we got to do now. Like that I like that format. But as far as, like, you know, this being a standalone with serious potential, as we like to say, I don't think that one works as well. But if this was supposed to be just one self-contained thing, I do think you can get away with, like, a part three that is only, you know, a couple of chapters long, that is like them dealing with what we just found out and in the height of the book from the flashback.
That is actually a question that I have, is sort of, you know, you talk about part one, they're trying to find out what happened to these siblings. And I'm kind of curious why, like, when they find out what happens, right?
I was thinking, I'm like, why do you care? Like, yeah.
That should be the thing that kicks off the reason for it. Because once you have established a reason we have to find out, well, then what, you know, what is it, right? So if it is something like, that was my mom, then having a sort of, like, kind of landing makes more sense as opposed to, and now we must go fight the armies of hell with our kaiju god monster. I don't know.
I would submit, if there is no meaningful impact in the people in the present of why this all happened, make the entire story about the people in the past. Yeah. The entire book. That's also what happened. Is what happened to the siblings.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Which at that point, you could almost do it more like a framing story, where it's like you've got one chapter of, like, you know, like Titanic, right? Like, we're gonna talk to this woman, and then the whole story,
like, the Princess Bride,
story. And then at the end, it's like, okay, that was the story. I'm gonna go throw the necklace in the water,
which is like the most depressing thing. But then Rose is basically just like, "F you to my whole entire family.
Okay.
F you for this movie. When I die, I'm gonna go and be with him that I wanted to be with the entire time."
I was 9 years old when I saw that movie. My mom and I walk out of the theater. We get in the car and I'm like, at the end of the movie, she shouldn't have seen a vision of Jack holding out his hand over the water, and then she put it in his hand and it falls into the water. And my mom looked at me and was like, who hurt you? Like, what? You're a monster.
it's a big
heard it from you, Mom.
Yeah. Sorry.
Exactly. Because you're like, yeah, it's my one true love. And it's like, yeah, but you live like 70 more years. And you're surrounded by people that really care about you. And just being like, I'd have cashed in 100% of you motherfuckers. That's not the, I mean, yeah, people get mad about whether or not there was room on the door. That's
I do want to.
That's one of those moments where it's like, maybe it was in the outline, but maybe you should have thought about it again.
Yeah. I do quickly just kind of want to say, because there was the generic question there of, like, how do you handle the falling action? I will say that, like, the book that I sent Aaron, like, I was shocked at how quickly that falling action actually happened when I did it, because there's only, like, the end of the fight happens and then there's like two chapters, and that was all that it needed. And it was because it was like, hey, the big fight is over, all of the action has fallen, and we're just dealing really quick with what's going on there. I don't think
show the new status quo.
Yeah, there does not have to be the Lord of the Rings ending.
Yep,
we don't need that.
Exactly what I was about to say. I always leave them wanting more, because if they finish that movie with, "Oh no, my friends, you bow to no one," it would be absolutely flawless. Yeah, you don't want a Peter Jackson it. They were just like so desperate to prove that Sam and Frodo weren't gay. And yeah.
Still didn't work.
Nope.
All right, one more.
Yeah.
Hey, Tangenteers, two-parter here. So I've heard authors talk about paying attention to the market to see what's in for books. If vampire books are so last year, would it be a bad idea to go ahead and write the vampire story you have in your head? What do you all think about writing to the market? That's the first question.
I mean, I've heard in the time that I've been working in entertainment, 20 years now, I've heard about 5 different times that zombies were dead, vampires were dead, and then there was more zombie movies and more vampire movies. Write the story, but understand you may have to put it in your drawer for a time. Let it out of your head, but you know, understand it may or may not be the right time for it. I mean, if you have... I have very much written scripts for the market, but again, writing scripts is easy and fast.
Yeah.
A novel is a whole other undertaking, especially when there's by no means a guarantee that the girl next door that has two boys that are madly in love with her and she can't decide is the flavor of the moment, that your 12th entry into that category is going to move anybody, especially if you did it because it was popular and not because you had something to say.
Yeah, that's the thing, is like there's sort of like writing to market, like looking around and going, nobody is buying X, right? Dystopia got very saturated, for example, and right now everybody's like, that's called life, so I don't want it. That doesn't mean there's never going to be another successful dystopian novel, because trends wax and wane. And so if you have a dystopian novel in your heart and you're going to write the hell out of it, you probably should.
The Handmaid's Tale hit different before it came true.
Right? But that's different than sort of going, hey, the hot new book is pirate vampires or whatever, so I'm going to write a pirate vampire book, because by the time you do that, it's not going to be the trend anymore.
Yeah.
So I think there's sort of like knowing what is the general like genre category, right? It's hard to, for example, sell a really long middle grade book. You can look at the market and go, oh, the page count looks like this. But there are always going to be books that kind of throw that out the window, and do something cool and innovative and start the trends. And I feel like you are better served writing the thing that you're passionate about, that you were really going to do a good job writing, than trying to figure out what's going to be hot when you finish it. Because it might take you, it might take you years to write a novel, but at the very least, it's going to take you months.
Yeah.
And so, and then it's going to take years to come out, theoretically. Like, this doesn't move super fast.
Yeah.
If you are self-publishing and you are a fast writer, this is sort of a different equation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so you'll see the little sort of bursts of things come out, and all the, right now I feel like it's just piles and piles of alliterated legends and lattes. Chasers.
I like that book.
people do, and that's why there's suddenly a lot of cozy fantasy that has a very similar title structure, right? That's what kind of hot right now. If you right now decide to write that, people might be sick of it by the time you get to publish it, or maybe you'll really knock it out of the park and help it revitalize. I don't know, but at the end of the day, like, don't write for an imaginary audience.
Write for yourself.
I got a buddy who shall remain nameless, who writes about a novel a month. This is like every month is NaNoWriMo, and it'll be 50,000 words.
Damn.
And he just dominates a certain niche, and he knows the book is going to make him, he self-publishes. He was with a publisher for a while, but he self-publishes now. He knows the book is going to make him $2,000 or $3,000. And it's like, and that's just the engine, you know, that it's damn. Like, that. Again, I'm being vague on purpose, because I don't want to bust him for that, what, you know, his move. But I mean, he just knows that's the move.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That it's not, I'm not going for mass produce. I'm not going to make millions and millions of dollars. I'm adding another brick in the wall, you know, that builds up over time. But he dominates a very specific niche in Amazon because of that. It's not, I mean, for our purposes, to continue this example, it's not just legends and lattes. It's cozy, food-based, lesbian orc.
Is your friend Chuck Tingle?
Dun, dun, dun.
I was going to ask that too.
That's very specific.
What are they doing with this food?
What aren't they doing with this food? that's you know, but I mean, that's his strategy.
Yeah,
you know.
You did make me realize there when you talk about Legends of Lattes and people chase that. I was just like, wait a minute. I wrote like a first draft outline of a cozy novel before I got sick at the beginning of the year. Where is that?
Now might be the time. I got sick and
totally forgot about it.
There's still time for you to beat me to mainstream novel publication, Trevor. You can do it. You can do it.
But yeah, I literally what I was going to say is exactly what Aaron was just like, hey, if you're going to write for market, I hope you write fast. It's essentially the way I look at it is write for yourself and hope the market waves are going in that way.
It's just, I mean, yes. But I mean, everybody's so pissed at Netflix because it's formulaic. I feel like it's so hard to write for the market and not have it be formulaic. Maybe you can. You know,
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just saying, if you're just like, ooh, I too will write a vampires in high school book. It's like, I mean, you know, say whatever you want about Stephanie Myers. And I have a lot of strong thoughts about Twilight. I've had multiple women tell me that the thing, even though she's a terrible writer, the thing she does very well is she very clearly captures what it's like to be a young girl in love.
I'm glad that book did not exist when I was a teenager.
Right? So, but that was something Stephanie Myers had to say, you know, and therefore she said it. Mm-hmm.
I was gonna say I have like a sort of counter example. A friend of mine, we have the same agent, Amelia Brunskill, she wrote a book called Wolf Pack, which is a YA novel. It is written in verse. It is a novel written entirely in verse, because when she started this story, which is sort of about, it's kind of like Yellow Jackets, but the epic, the poem. Mm-hmm. She started it and she just sort of like felt this language fitting to it. And she's like, I'm going to try this thing. And yeah, it worked. And she got it published. I think she got it reviewed in the New York Times, which is pretty great. I think I might be remembering wrong, but anyway, like it's delightful and it's what it's supposed to be. And so like, you know, if there's something about the market that really moves you, or if that's really what you want to do is just kind of like make the things that you think you can, you know, sell. Okay, great. But if you want to do something weird, don't hide from it, because you can make something really cool.
Yeah, I will also say, I guess in conclusion, I never believe when people are like, that wave of that thing is over, because it comes back around, especially if you do a good job.
All right, what was the second question?
Second question, what's the deal with contemporary adult fiction? Is this a real genre with borders? Absolutely love the podcast. Thanks, guys. Samantha.
I mean, what are we calling contemporary adult phase and all of it?
Contemporary adult fiction, I think, is often shelved as general fiction. And it's basically fiction set in the real world. Meant for adults. And that it does not adhere to genre, right? There might be a romance in it, but it's not a romance novel. There might be something sort of speculative about it, but it is not a science fiction or fantasy novel. There's also a place here where it sort of overlaps, because you can have things that are that are contemporary adult fiction that are sort of commercial contemporary adult fiction, and then you can have literary fiction. And literary fiction is going to be similar to contemporary adult fiction, but it's going to be more concerned with the language and the prose. It might do interesting things with a structure and experiment more with the form. With contemporary adult fiction, it is going to be more sort of more unexpected shape, more commercial.
I went to Goodreads, or I typed in contemporary adult fiction and it brought me a Goodreads list. And mm-hmm. So this is the list that it has: The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, Beach Read, Normal People, Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine, The Unhoneymooners, The Hating Game. Down here is Red, White, and Royal Blue, and I'm like, okay, so this is
that's romance. That's a romance novel, and
it's the love YA, hypothesis is also no, it's not. I don't think it is. Is it?
I
don't
know. It was.
Maybe it is. But yeah, like the love hypothesis is on here and stuff. Like, yeah, this kind of just feels, I'm like, okay, so like just not fantasy novels, nothing that has weird stuff in it.
I mean, so this is where you can get kind of things that are a little tricky, because like Margaret Atwood has famously said, I don't write science fiction, but Margaret Atwood does write things which have sort of science fictional elements or are kind of set in the future, or things which are definitely have something kind of eerie and supernatural going on, but it's going to handle it in a very like straightforward way.
I mean, again, it hit different before it came true.
Well, that one, yeah. I was thinking of, actually, one of my favorite books of hers is The Robber Bride, which I read when I was like a teenager. And I was thinking recently I should read it again because I think it would hit very different now that I'm an adult. Those books you read when you're like young and you don't actually understand anything about the world. I'm so curious. Like, I don't ever remember what they are, but I'm curious for that one. But yeah, it's but anyway, so you know, you can get books where there is something about it that sort of approaches the genre, something genre related, but it isn't doing other things about the genre. So, which also doesn't necessarily mean that you can't, like, Michael Chabon wrote a book called, I think it was The Yiddish Policeman's Union was the one, which is sort of an alternate history future where rather than settling in Israel, the country,
Jewish people,
I'm trying to think of what
Israel?
The word of, no, sorry,
Judah.
My brain got stuck looking for a word that means a place more specific than a country, and I don't know what I'm looking for. Anyway, it's
city?
In Alaska.
Right,
homeland. Okay, yeah. So they're like, okay, because apparently this was something that was discussed, right? And so, you know, now, you know, it's basically like a crime story, but it's a crime story in a world that's very different, that's different from this one, right? And I think it won a Hugo, which, you know, it was not published by a fantasy or science fiction publisher. I can't remember if it was that one or if it was Cavalier and Clay. But anyway, so like, you know, genre is a squishy marketing thing anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I look at something like Black Mirror, which some of the stories were completely fantastical with, you know, people living on space stations and having their Cylon bodies walking around on Earth. And then other things were, several of their episodes are 100% technology that exists right now. So, I mean, and then you get into the hard and soft science fiction and sociological science fiction, and you can get into quite a lot of navel gazing pretty quickly. I mean, I love me some plasma rifles. Like, we're going through this in my house right now with anime selections. My oldest is just is adamant she doesn't like isekai anime, which is, you know, somebody goes to another world. She, in all of her 16-year-old hubris and outrage, you know, she cannot stand anything isekai. And then my youngest only wants romantic comedies. She didn't want drama. She didn't. No real conflict. You know, she wants to know that basically everybody's almost certainly going to get together at the end and be happy. And so we sit down to pick some anime, and I'm like, "Look, man, I love me a good romance subplot, but somebody's got to fight somebody. Like, I need a sword. I need a fireball. I need if I'm going to take the time to engage with this medium, like, it's not just to watch two kids in high school, you know, be awkward. I'm just not gonna, you know, so I get it.
That's fair.
Yeah. Hey, that was all the questions you sent me.
Well, I think that is a good place to wrap things up. We're a little bit early, but that's fine. We got plenty more questions to go and plenty more listener episodes for you.
Didn't you say there was like an addendum to one of them, or did you already do it?
I did it. That was the contemporary adult fiction question.
Ah. Yeah. But yeah, that's a good place to wrap things up. Friends, where can people find you? What awesome things are you working on?
You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Aaron M. Evans. And I guess Instagram at All the Irinies. I don't know. I'm trying something, guys.
You can join me on twitch.tv/dungeonscrawlers every Monday at 1:30 p.m. Pacific for concentration check, co-writing space. Come get some Pomodoro sprints done with me. And then again on Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. for Fearful Symmetry, which is in its last few episodes.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, she's getting dun. Real, y'all. You can pick up my book, Empire of Exiles, at all fine bookstores, and you will have about 3 months to read it before Relics of Ruin comes out. Please pre-order if you are interested in a twisty skeleton mystery with a lot of drama. And then, yeah, that's all I got, I think.
Let me know if you need any help making your denouement worse. For the show there. I specialize in worse in final.
I'll talk to you later.
Sorry, not sorry, Trevor. That's all I have to say. Right now, mostly doing TTRPG stuff. However, I don't know when you're going to hear this, but I'm running the promo on the Undisputed Academy again. So it's theundisputedacademy.com. The promo code's 14day50. So you can get 50% off for the aforementioned 14-day writer. Save 5 years off of your journey into becoming a professional writer. 14-day DM, player, and TTRPG creator, in case those are any things that you're interested in. So theundisputedacademy.com. Use code 14day50. Also, apparently, once I get done with these deadlines, I got to start writing a novel because I got to get mainstream publication before.
Hey,
it's a race.
It's a race. yeah, you can follow me on all the dystopian social medias at the Trevor. There's an A hiding in there. I am not that active on them right now. I am taking a break from social media, and I will be honest, it's very nice. That's going to do it for this week's episode. Thank you all so much for listening and writing in. If you want to write in with your own questions like the lovely people who did tonight, you can send those into writingaboutdragonsandshit@gmail.com. And if you'd like to keep up to date on the show, you can follow us on Blue Sky @AboutDragons. But until next week, go write about some dragons and shit.